There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Gartner has released its forecast for Middle East technology spending. In the Middle East and North Africa, we're going to get $155 billion spent this year. And as luck would have it, the global head of research for Gartner is sitting in this very studio. He is Peter Sondergaard, and he's with us. Morning, Peter. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're in town. We'd like to think it was to talk to the business breakfast. Actually, you're in town because Gartner's got a symposium happening in Dubai at the moment. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. First of all, though, this figure of $155 billion, a modest 3% increase. What's driving that, and how do we stack up against the rest of the world?
Actually, from a growth perspective, compared to the rest of the world, this is actually pretty good. It's a solid growth rate. It's actually the fastest growth in 3 years. The main part of that number is made up by telecommunication services, which essentially is primarily us using our mobile phone. But apart from that, the growth comes from software and from services around implementation of technology.
Two things in this forecast really stood out for me. The first one you've just mentioned, but it's one little part of that. When you say that a lot of the growth is going to come from telecoms, you're not just talking about increased data spending, us buying more data, but also buying more voice services. I thought voice services were on their way out.
They are. The growth comes from anything that has to do with data on our mobile devices. But if you sort of split it up between fixed line and then mobile line, obviously the world is going mobile. So that's why it's data on mobile, and it is once in a while also us doing the occasional call on our cell phones.
I was also really interested to see that in amongst the things that we are spending on, what we're not spending as much on is cloud computing, cloud services. This region has the lowest spend as a percentage of the IT budget on cloud in the world. Why do you think that is?
I think we still lack the implementation of large, what we call hyperscale data centers that actually can run the cloud services. There's not a sufficient capacity in this market for it. It is growing, but there's not a sufficient capacity. You probably also need to see a bit more competition. So there's not enough providers that actually drive the competition. We do have players that are entering the market, but it is an important aspect that I think we need to address in this market over the course of the next couple of years, essentially because cloud is eating into everything that has to do with technology these days.
So if we look at some of the big areas of spending, and you talk about the mobile phone being the fundamental driver, whether it's voice or whether it's data, where's that money going? When we talk about technology, let's define what we're talking about here. $155 billion is a very, very big number. Are we talking about the infrastructure behind the mobile phones rather than spending on handsets?
Yeah. I mean, the actual handset doesn't appear in the telecommunication number because that's a device these days, no different really than a PC. So the number on telecommunications is all the infrastructure that runs essentially society these days. And that's why the number is so big. It's also obviously the associated services that are delivered by telecommunication operators that are paid by end users of technologies or large companies and government. So the handset appears elsewhere. In the handset side of things, the money there isn't actually growing because while there are a few handsets that perhaps have become more expensive, on average, actually, the unit price of handsets and the unit price of access with devices is actually more or less flat. We're benefiting from, you know, hyper-competition in the handset space, as well as also hyper-competition in the PC space.
What do you expect to see happen to that competition? The current lineup that we've got at the moment, Samsung, then Apple, Huawei and the rest of them kind of coming up behind. Do you expect to see that change fundamentally?
I think right now we have a pretty decent equilibrium between, if you step back, between two different operating systems, and that's where the stability is. One is Android, and the other one really is iOS, which is Apple. Behind that, you tend to have much greater competition, obviously, in the Android space. That's where you tend to, over the last couple of years, have seen some of the Chinese manufacturers enter the market with lower-priced handsets. But if you look at the high end of the market, that's really defined by a duopoly between Samsung and Apple.
Who's getting a big chunk of this $155 billion? My sense would be that a lot of it, the vast majority, is going to international companies, whether it's device makers like the brands you mentioned, Samsung, Apple, Huawei, or whether it's the big infrastructure providers like the Nokias of this world and Ericssons and many others. What percentage of that money, $155 billion, is going outside the region?
It's a fairly substantial part of that money that goes to international players. Generally, if you look at the technology market, it is dominated by large players that we could call heritage players, the Ciscos, the Ericssons, the IBMs, the Oracles, the SAPs, the Microsofts, the Googles. They are the ones that actually take the predominant portion of revenue. Where you tend to see local players is in spaces such as services, and then in specialized vertical industry software segments where there are some regional players, but it's not a substantial portion of the market. So a lot of it flows to multinational players in the market.
When you say we're spending on software, what software are we spending on? What is the sort of the driving trend there?
There's probably three categories that we spend on. First is software that runs the basic infrastructure of organizations. So that would be our financial software, our HR software. So that's the first category. The second category would be things that have to do with managing data, managing information. And that really spans from tools that are analytic tools over to even things that drive collaboration using technology to actually drive collaboration. And the third category is sort of more of a mixed bag. It's specialized vertical industry software, like things that drive our supply chain environment, so supply chain-based software. Or, for that matter of fact, sort of specialized vertical industry software, say, for example, something that runs hospitals, patient record systems, and what have you. So that becomes very specific to industry.
I'm surprised that security isn't on that list, given what we've seen over the last 12 months in terms of high-profile attacks and much smarter attacks. In this part of the world, are we spending enough on security?
Here, or for that matter of fact, anywhere else in the world, we are not spending enough on security. Security as a set of software tools, and for that matter of fact, also more hardware-related security products, figure in many of the different categories. It's even found in the services segment. So there isn't, and there could potentially be a separate segment for security software. You will even find in some of the new topics that we seem to have consumed a lot of time over the last 12 months talking about, for example, artificial intelligence, is actually been used to detect security incidents far better than what human beings can do. So security is spread out in different segments.
We're talking technology with Peter Sondergaard. He is the global head of research at Gartner. Peter, thanks very much indeed for staying with us.
Thank you.
Let's look at some of the bigger picture issues facing the world of technology and facing society. Artificial intelligence is a huge thing. We've got a minister, we've got a council, we're taking it seriously. But of course, a lot of people have concerns about this. You were in Davos at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland just a few weeks ago, and this was one of the big talking points. A, from a technology perspective, but B, from a philosophical perspective, what does it mean for mankind? What did you learn?
A couple of things, actually. First, there's a lot of conversation about the fact that everything that has to do with artificial intelligence is really based on the data that you use. Data is sort of the input, and if you have flawed data, you're going to get flawed results. And data carries the bias of human beings. So, for example, imagine that we are trying to use our mobile data and artificial intelligence to detect behaviors. Well, mobile data generally is influenced by the fact that the younger generation uses mobile phones more than the older generation. So you're actually going to get biased or could get biased against older individuals in society. So it carries the bias. The software code around artificial intelligence may also carry bias because it could be written by individuals with a certain skew towards life. And so we have to be really careful about the bias that gets built into everything that has to do with artificial intelligence. And that's really the first thing, right? The second thing is the concern around jobs and what it does to the human race in terms of work, which is a huge topic of conversation and very polarizing, I would argue.
Yeah, there's two sort of camps there, isn't there? There's one camp that the jobs are going to go away. We need to be looking at universal basic incomes. Should we tax the companies producing the technology or the companies using it, et cetera, et cetera? And then the other camp sort of says, well, this has happened with every revolution, the industrial revolution, the knowledge revolution. Jobs don't go away. They just change. What side of the fence are you on?
Gartner is essentially on the side that says that following. First, this is actually going to be a longer transition in terms of an adoption curve than most people portray. And secondly, we don't actually know the totality of this. We would argue that what happens is the tasks replaced or are replaced by artificial intelligence. But on the other hand, new jobs get created as a result of artificial intelligence as well. So in the shorter term, we frankly believe that around 1.8 million jobs globally by 2020 will be lost to artificial intelligence. But another 2.3 million jobs will be created as a result of artificial intelligence. So you kind of have a net positive. And we think that actually carries in for the next decade in terms of there's both jobs lost and jobs gained.
Which changes the question, doesn't it, to which jobs then are most likely to disappear and what skill sets will people need to capture the new jobs?
Yeah, so first, probably repetitive white-collar jobs, paralegals. Or when you have sort of repetitive actuarian-based roles in insurance companies where you can use technology to do calculations that essentially are done by human beings today. Those are the kind of jobs that disappear, as opposed to what may happen later, which is more automation using artificial intelligence for things like trucking jobs. When you start to also get autonomous vehicles and therefore algorithms into cars, then there are certain jobs that disappear there. But initially, it's probably entry-level, white-collar jobs that have a lot to do with calculation of repetitive things.
Then what should people be studying, looking at, reskilling at? Now, Richard's got two boys. I mean, what should he be encouraging them to do in school? Should he be teaching them to code on the weekends? Or is it more the humanities, the sort of nuances of language that maybe automation can't replicate?
Well, it's really both. First, as I said earlier on, bias gets built into what we do, and therefore the ability to input information and understand information becomes really important. There's one end of the spectrum there that has to do with statistical knowledge, how you do analysis of data, but there's another element that is really about understanding human beings and knowing that certain data may carry bias or certain software code may carry bias. There'll be a lot of jobs initially created that has to do with actually entry of information, because again, systems don't work unless they have sufficient amount of data. So there'll be a lot of entry. There'll be a lot of training of systems done by human beings, and therefore a lot of jobs created doing that.
Where is this artificial intelligence going to happen? For example, Malcolm next week is going to Microsoft in Seattle. I was there last year, and they have their artificial intelligence platform, Azure, and they want people to companies based around the world to use their platform. Google wants people to use their platform and so on. But this raises issues, just as cloud computing does, about where the data is stored or where the data is processed. So for a company based in Dubai, say a legal company, for example, or insurance company, to quote the two examples you made, where will that AI happen, Peter?
I think initially a lot of it will be democratically used by everybody and very local, because it will be implemented in support of customer interaction on a website. And that would mean it would reside here. The data would reside here, or it will be implemented in systems that this legal company may use that are its own systems that also will reside here. So I think actually a lot of the data will still be local. Yes, there are global players like a Google or a Microsoft that will use artificial intelligence as support for their applications, or support in what they do from a mobile perspective or search perspective. But I think the predominant part of data today is actually private data that sits with private companies. And those companies, which are all obviously local here, will start to use that data in support of customer service, in support of benefit for citizens of a country. I mean, healthcare is going to be a huge benefactor of artificial intelligence, and that will be good for all of us.
What about ownership of that data? I was reading one of your blogs, and it mentioned the idea that we might all end up with more control over our data, that we might be able to sort of capitalize on it, withhold it, use it, monetize it ourselves, and sort of control who gets it. And I read that and I thought, it's very rare I disagree with you, by the way, but I thought, I feel like the opposite is happening to me in my daily life. I went to go and buy a hotel coupon the other day. I couldn't even see the website. The back of the website was blurred. Unless I put in my information, it wouldn't unblur it. I feel that more and more, unless you're willing to hand over that data, you can't transact.
Yes, and I agree that's how the world is defined today, because the world is really a battle about owning data, as I think we've also discussed earlier on this show, is data and information is the oil of the 21st century. But the speculation is at some stage we as citizens may actually decide that we want to own and control the data elements that define us, because this is also, again, a question of how far do we go in terms of giving away things. And I would argue if companies go too far in wanting to own our data, we may revolt in the sense that we want to own it ourselves and we want to actually monetize it ourselves. I want to generate money based on who uses my data. You kind of see that in some instances, is that you actually get value from giving something. Now, in this case, it might be the blurred website, but it could be coupons to actually purchase something cheaper. So it is happening. It's just a different kind of economy. But you could speculate that it could go as far as maybe we own it and we sell it, as opposed to Google sells our information to advertisers.
30 seconds. You're going to be talking with chief information officers, chief technology officers from Middle East companies and governments during your symposium here over the next day or two. What's the big question that they're asking you? What's the question you get asked most at the moment?
Nothing to do with technology. It is actually all about how do we get what we would in Gartner call digital to the core of the business or the core of the government agency. And that is actually all about leadership. It's all about do I have the right leaders that understand the balance between running the business today and what it needs to be in the future? It's about talent. How do I actually attract the right kind of talent to my organization? Not just the traditional challenges in this region around talent, but is actually how do I find somebody that can lead an artificial intelligence organization? And I can tell you in big cities and urban environments, so for example, in Delhi, there are only right now 31 people that have ever managed an artificial intelligence organization. So you can imagine the competition that exists for critical skill set is very important, and that's the conversation.
Fascinating stuff. Peter Sondergaard is Global Head of Research at Gartner. Enjoy your time in Dubai. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.